Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the American Jewish Experience, Part 2. We'll be discussing tonight American Jews and the law. And we're sponsored this year by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ila Nishmat Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib, and I thank them again for their sponsorship. So, of course, the Jewish people have always had an affinity for the law. We're the people of the book, and that book, the Torah, is a book of laws with a narrative that provides the context for those laws. Our lives are regimented by laws and customs. We casually define people based on their observance of these laws, shomrei mitzvot or not. And we love to argue and debate the nuances of the law. Much of Talmud Torah involves dissecting the mitzvot to understand their basic elements, so we contrast different halachot in order to ascertain their defining and distinguishing principles. That's how Jews learn Torah, and that really is a way of life. During my first week of law school, I was assigned to a study group that by happenstance consisted of four yeshiva students, including me, and one young woman. And the study group prepares for the class lectures by discussing and analyzing cases and trying to determine the holding of the case, which is the essential point on which the decision was based and the facts that support the holding, as opposed to the dicta. There are other points that were not essential to the holding. And that's the case analysis that takes place in law school. So the four of us are arguing back and forth until the young woman chimes in, "Did you study this already?" And I answered her, "We've been doing this for about 12 years now." And that's the reality. So Jews can be legalistic, litigious, didactic, always looking for sources, always referring to our books for guidance, sometimes even to prove our misguided notions and rationalize our errant ways. But it's undeniable that law and Jews intersect. At one time, I recall, at least a third of the rabbis in Teaneck had practiced law at one point. And this, even though we're taught in Masechet Avot, the first parak, Al tas atzmecho orchei hadayonim. Do not make yourself into one of those lawyers, or literally an orech din, one who arranges the law, meaning someone who manipulates facts, sometimes judges, to help someone subvert justice. So one pertinent question we should address even briefly is the propriety of Jews practicing law. Sounds strange. We all know the prohibition of Jews litigating their affairs in secular court. Ve'ela ha'mishpatim asher tasim lifneihem, lifneihem ve'lo lifnei ovdei kochavim. These are the laws that you should place before them. We place our laws, our decisions, our adjudications before other Jews and not before non-Jews. It's considered an insult to the Torah to refer to secular Gentile law when the law of the Torah is divine and superior. So can a Jew even practice law? What if your client wins money from someone else in violation of Torah law? What if you prosecute someone who is then punished not according to Torah law? So certainly to represent non-Jews is not an issue, because Noahides are obligated to establish a system of justice. And within that system, as long as the laws are moral and organized, a Jew can practice. The bigger problem is representing Jews, and really whether as a plaintiff or defendant. No less an authority than Rav Menashe Klein opined that it is almost impossible. And this is the Shut Mishnah Halachot, Chelek Vav Siman Shin Yud Gimel. He said, "Lefi ani yodaiti, in my humble opinion, davar zeh gam ken kashe ma'od li'izaher. It's very difficult to be careful, liot al pi Torah, to be a lawyer according to the Torah." And certainly, it's almost impossible when you're representing the government. Devaday asur liot kihu mochrach ladun b'nei Yisrael b'dineihem. You're forced to adjudicate Jews according to their laws, lefamim afil bedina nefashot, even capital crimes, which is difficult. According to this, it would be hard to be a Jewish judge and sentence other Jews. How to sit on a jury as a Jew and sentence other Jews, not according to the Torah. See, he said it's almost impossible and people shouldn't even try. Well, this tshuva attracted the ire of one Rabbi Judah Dick, Esquire, very well known as a lawyer and an Askon and a Talmud Chacham, and he protested, and he said he's been a lawyer for a government law, more than 13 years. In Chelek Zion, Siman Reish Nun Hei, Rav Menashe Klein said, quoted him saying that in all his years, Lo nichshal chas v'shalom be'isa lifnei iver. He was never once over any prohibition, including not inducing someone else to sin, whether our code going to secular court or gzeila, kigon motzi momani yisur b'dineihem, shelo kedin, taking money from one Jew to another, given to another Jew, meaning plaintiff, Jewish plaintiff wins a case against Jewish defendant, but the Torah would have ruled otherwise. And Judah Dick said, no, if anything, he's able to mechazik the Torah, etc. Rav Menashe Klein said, Omer ani, ashrelo shezochon liyot nizhar, v'lo nichshal b'isurei Torah. Fortunate is he who is privileged to be careful and not violate any of the laws of the Torah. Avol bemet lav kol odom zochel azeh. Not everybody is privileged to succeed in that vein. But of course we note that Rav Menashe Klein also opposed attending college, and he opposed certainly law school, and he did concede that representing Gentiles is not prohibited, because this is their system. Since most lawyers will not be able to resist representing Jews, it should be forbidden. Others disagree. It still is an open question. If a Jewish lawyer violates Lifnei Iver when his Jewish client insists on suing another Jew in civil court, criminal cases are not such an issue because Beit Din has no jurisdiction in criminal matters. And the practice of law has become something prevalent in American Jewish life. We, as you all know, are disproportionately represented in the attorney class, and such is not surprising given our history. So how have American Jews impacted law in the United States? And we'll begin on the dark side with the heyday of Jewish gangsters and the revolution they brought about in the underworld. And that's the Jewish mafia. So it's hard to imagine today, but for a good part of the first half of the last century, Jewish gangsters were active, effective, influential, and even transformative. There was a Jewish mafia, nicknamed, among other things, the Kosher Nostra. Some of them were quite brutal, some were cold-blooded killers, all were absolutely fascinating individuals, because many of them grew up in religious homes, and some of them even remained religious of sorts. I've always been captivated by the story of one Samuel, nicknamed Red Levine, lived 1902 to 1972. Red Levine was a hitman for Murder, Inc., which is the mob of Lucky Luciano, who was an Orthodox Jew, Shomer Shabbat, who actually refused to kill on Shabbat, except, as the literature tells us, when necessary. I quote, "But if the job had to be done, he kissed his mezuzah, said his prayers draped in a tallit, wore a skull cap under his hat, as he headed out," end quote, he headed out to kill whomever he had to kill. Now, this was not an uncommon career path for immigrants or their children, especially for the less intellectually gifted, like Levine, who nevertheless was clever enough never to have been arrested. And when Murder, Inc. was disbanded in 1940, he simply dropped out and lived another 32 years. This is true of the Irish and the Italians, to some extent the blacks as well, and also the Jews. Eventually, one might say, we came to our senses and left the excesses of the underworld to others who could not move up the socioeconomic ladder without it. As Mario Puzo put it in The Godfather's Mouth, one lawyer with a briefcase can steal more than 100 men with guns. I'm not justifying or rationalizing any of this. I'm just trying to understand the mentality. The Jews have occasionally fallen prey to white-collar crimes, much less to violent crimes that exist also. We cook up schemes too many schemes, shameful schemes, and big time. And Bernie Madoff made Ponzi look like a piker. And part of the problem, a good problem, is that we are still shocked when these things happen. So we know that they can happen, but we just can't believe that someone would actually do it. So how did it happen that Jews became so involved in the underworld and accomplished so much? Malcolm Gladwell once wrote that the Jewish gangsters of the early 20th century couldn't hope for the rewards of hard work. They couldn't conform when no one would let them try. Yet they revered America and all it stood for. Crime was the means by which a group of immigrants could transcend their humble origins. Criminal activity under those circumstances was not rebellion. It wasn't a rejection of legitimate society. It was an attempt to join it. So there's some truth to that, but it's not entirely true. Not just because Jews, especially Jews who raised in religious homes, should have known better. So for example, the original kingpin was Arnold Rothstein, who was nicknamed the Brain, who, like many, made his money in bootlegging. So Rothstein started a trend. He was very suave, very stylish. Gangsters of the 20th century, especially Italians, basically mimicked his style. So he grew up on the Upper West Side. His father, Abraham, was a wealthy businessman, an Orthodox Jew. Arnold's older brother, Harry, became a rabbi. And part of Arnold's mischief was his jealousy of an antagonism towards his brother Harry. So he could have made it in that world. He wasn't a poor immigrant without connections. But he was drawn to the excitement of gambling, which eventually became his downfall. Rothstein rejected mitzvot at his bar mitzvah, telling his father, "This is America, not Jerusalem." To this day, he's accused of fixing the 1919 World Series and making a fortune from it, but despite the notoriety, it has never been conclusively proven. He was never prosecuted for it. Allegedly, he paid off certain Chicago White Sox players to fail at key junctures in a game, in several games, and he bet on the Cincinnati Reds. It's a brilliant scheme, if you think about it, because baseball is a game where the best players fail 70% of the time. So it should be easy to conceal. Eight players were bought off. They all hated their owner, Charles Comiskey, who made all the money and paid them peanuts, including shoeless Joe Jackson, who hit .375 in the World Series and made no errors, and whose involvement is still disputed. It took a year for the scandal to unfold, as even though the White Sox were favored, they only lost 5-3. The eight were banned from baseball for life, and until today, every major league team has a sign, a big sign in the clubhouse, warning players against betting on games and the lifetime expulsion that comes with it. Pete Rose is still denied entry into the Baseball Hall of Fame because of his gambling, even though he bet on his own team to win. Rothstein is widely presumed to have been the mastermind and therefore responsible for everything that took place in the last century in terms of the warnings and penalties for gambling in baseball, but who knows? There's a whole genre of books on this topic. Rich Cohn wrote a book entitled Tough Jews, Fathers, Sons, and Gangster Dreams. Michael Schneerson wrote a book, Bugsy Siegel. Robert Rockaway wrote a book, But He Was Good to His Mother, The Lives of Jewish Gangsters. And they were good to their mothers, and they had none of the resentment towards Judaism that, for example, the Hollywood moguls that we discussed last time had. What they did have was the resentment as to how Jews were treated by the establishment. And they resented, they rebelled against victimhood and passivity, and they fought back. For all the homicides they committed, they took pride in that they only killed bad guys. And the money they made was in businesses that they felt the establishment was getting rich on. It was strange, to say the least. The most influential figure historically was Meyer Lansky, who was born in Grodno In 1902, the years 1902 to 1983, Mayor Sucholansky, and by chance, as an 18-year-old, met Arnold Rothstein at a bar mitzvah in Brooklyn. Rothstein was impressed, and he hired Lansky to work with him in bootlegging, which was a lucrative business during Prohibition. It's estimated that half the bootleggers in America were Jews. From Rothstein's perspective, it was a great business because everything was legal. Their sources were in Canada for the cheap stuff, England for the high-end liquor. Everything was legal until it crossed the American border. And that is where Lansky came in. He was a genius for organization, what we would call today logistics. He kept track of what was coming in, where it was going, where it should be going, who was protecting the shipment, and who had to be paid off. I don't doubt that if Meyer Lansky was still alive today, we'd have no supply chain crisis in America. Lansky was friends with Bugsy Siegel. Benjamin Siegel was called Bugsy, but never to his face, since they were children. And he brought Bugsy Siegel into this business as well for the muscle. They were all tough. Lansky was small. Siegel was not. He was well-built. Once a group of Italians, young Italians, surrounded a teenage Lansky and demanded money from him. He refused in a linguistically colorful way, fought them, and so impressed one of the gang with his spirit and courage, they eventually linked up. That Italian was Charles Lucky Luciano. And they all became incredibly rich and fairly quickly. And it was Lansky's creative and criminal genius that a year after Rothstein was killed in 1928 for not paying gambling debts he owed, Lansky brought together Irish, Italian, and Jewish mobs at a conference in Atlantic City, and together they formed what was called the Syndicate. In essence, Lansky convinced them to run their criminal enterprises like a business, organized, efficient, dividing up territory, minimizing competition, and thereby violence. In a nutshell, talk about the impact of Jews on the law, it was Lansky who put the organized in organized crime. Their objective was to make money. Violence was secondary and to be avoided whenever possible, especially a scenario like Capone's Valentine's Day Massacre in Chicago that had taken place a few months earlier. From Lansky's perspective, violence interfered with business, and therefore it was to be avoided. And it worked. And that began the heyday of organized crime in America. Different criminal families set up in various cities, and the Jewish mob extended also across America. There were Jewish mob families in New York, Philadelphia, Detroit, Baltimore, Miami, Chicago, and elsewhere, with no shortage of colorful names. We're only used to the colorful Italian nicknames. We had Waxy Gordon, Dopey Fine, Dutch Schultz, Longy Zwillman, Jip the Blood Horowitz, Jacob Gura Shapiro, Louis Lepke Buchalter, and a host of lefties and a bunch of reds as well. It goes without saying that some of them were psychopaths. Bugsy Siegel murdered dozens of people. Red Levine, as I mentioned, was a contract killer for Murder, Inc. and for the Jewish mob. There was a Jew named Big Jack Zelig, who actually published a price list for his customers, ranging from slash on cheek with knife, he would charge $1 to $10, shot in arm, $5 to $25, murder, $10 to $100. So apparently you could handle with him, but not for long. It was Meyer Lansky, more than anyone else, who set up the mafia that the Italians would run. So it's unlikely he himself ever killed anyone, but he did order or acquiesce on hits on others. I was saying it's unlikely that Meyer Lansky ever killed anyone, but he did acquiesce to hits on others. And he managed the business very well. Bootlegging ended with Prohibition in 1933. Overnight, a profitable industry was about destroyed. but he segued into gambling, including moving into Havana and above all to Las Vegas as well. Oh. Ben Siegel was the one who really created Las Vegas. Because his father was poor, he felt it necessary after his bar mitzvah that he had to earn money to support his family. He was strong, he was handsome, and he had a violent temper. As teenagers in a street fight, a gun fell to the street and Siegel reached to pick it up. Lansky ordered him to drop it. Later, Siegel asked Lansky why he didn't let him just kill the guy, and Lansky said, "Use your head. The police were there. Only a schlamazel would shoot with the cops in sight. You'd be in big trouble." And that was the difference between them. Lansky always used his head. Siegel married his childhood girlfriend, Esther. They had two daughters on whom he doted, and they moved to Scarsdale. In fact, both Siegel and Lansky married Kedat Moshe v'Yisrael with a regular rabbi. In the 1930s, Bugsy Siegel had a vision of what Las Vegas could be, and he began building the Flamingo Hotel in the 1940s. So he envisioned an entertainment, gambling, and womanizing complex that would be relatively free of law enforcement because it was in the desert. And he was correct. Alas, once it opened, he was caught skimming time after time, and eventually the order was given and reluctantly approved by Lansky to eliminate him, which he was, shot through his bedroom window in Los Angeles. It was June 20th, 1947, 2 months after his father had died. So in the Bialystok Shul, their memorial plaques are actually one on top of the other. Max Siegel, and underneath him, Benjamin Siegel. And as art and life conflate, Bugsy Siegel was the inspiration for Mo Green, who was killed in The Godfather, but who was named by Mario Puzo for the real-life Las Vegas Jewish gangsters Mo Sidway and Gus Greenbaum, who took over the Flamingo when Siegel was killed. And yet Siegel was proudly Jewish. It's interesting that when his daughter Millicent died in Las Vegas in 2017, the Jewish community refused to bury her in their cemetery. After all, she was the daughter of a mobster. Rabbi Mendy Harlig, the Chabadnik, the several Harligs as the Chabad, leading Chabad family in Las Vegas, so Rabbi Mendy Harlig chastised them. And he said, "You don't know what he and his friends did for Jews on the Lower East Side. The Italians and Irish were horrible to the Jews. Ben Siegel protected these people." And Rabbi Harlig buried her in the Chabad Cemetery in Henderson, just 4 years ago. In fact, most of the gangsters were proud Jews. Again, unlike the moguls. Lansky and his gang in the 1930s would break up rallies of the German-American pro-Nazi Bund and give them a thrashing. This was at the secret request of New York State Judge Nathan Perlman. And Lansky even declined Lucky Luciano's offer of assistance, saying this was a Jewish manner. And he said, Lansky, "We chased them and beat them up. And some of them were out of action for months. Yes, it was violence. We wanted to teach them a lesson. We wanted to show them that Jews would not always sit back and accept insults." Judge Perlman offered money. Lansky turned it down. It was on the house. The only condition was he agreed not to kill anyone. So again, if you think back to how the moguls basically hid their Jewish identity so as not to have to confront the Nazis, they still wanted their movies to be shown in Germany, and ran from the Holocaust, and ran from the State of Israel. So you see, the gangsters were the exact opposite. The Jewish mob hated the Nazis. And as one writer put it, because of their own tendencies, they had no illusions as to the evil to which human beings could sink. Several years later, the war's going on, and Naval Intelligence reached out to Meyer Lansky for help with the Longshoremen's Union, which is controlled by the Mafia. He did, in exchange for getting Lucky Luciano, I guess by then he was unlucky, freed from prison. Luciano was convicted in the great Murder, Inc. trial of 1936, prosecuted by Thomas E. Dewey, and sentenced to 30 to 50 years in prison. Lansky succeeded in having Luciano exiled to Italy, where Luciano helped the Americans invade Sicily, and from there Lansky had him brought to Havana. The ports were not a problem thereafter, and the connections helped even more when Jews started smuggling weapons to Israel from the New York ports in 1946, 47, 48, on the direction of Teddy Kollek. The Jewish mob connections and the close ties that Lansky forged with the Italian mafia facilitated this. Not only that, they all funneled money to help Jews during the Holocaust. Most of the mobsters were big supporters of Israel. Representatives of the Haganah and the Irgun would meet mobsters in New York, in L.A., in the dead of night, in rooms with just them, and as one recalled, a bevy of blondes, and they received suitcases full of cash. What a contrast to the Hollywood moguls. At one gathering in 1947, Mickey Cohn, who was the head of the Jewish mob in L.A., gathered his friends, so to speak, pledged, and immediately gave $25,000 in cash, and then assigned numbers to the others who were there. Reuven Dafni, who was the Haganah envoy, made his pitch to Bugsy Siegel, who said to him, "You mean to tell me the Jews are fighting?" And Dafni said, "Yes." And Siegel said, "You mean fighting as in killing?" "Yes." And Siegel said, "I'm with you." Daphne estimated Bugsy Siegel gave him $50,000 in cash in suitcases by himself over the course of a few months in 1946 and 1947. Over time, they became legitimate, and Jews were more likely to be the lawyers for the mobsters than the mobsters themselves. The Jewish mob built most of the Las Vegas casinos, and then they receded. And this in turn validated something that a young Meyer Lansky had said. "Don't worry. Look at the Astors and the Vanderbilts, all those big society people. They were the worst thieves. And now look at them. It's just a matter of time." Lest you think this is all to glamorize crime, so we've made other contributions as well to American legal life. Jews have been in the forefront of many important legal doctrines and cases. Civil rights was always uppermost in the Jewish mind, being a minority subjected to persecution and discrimination in employment, housing, education. We're sensitive to inequitable treatment under the law, the extent that Jews, liberal Jews, became big supporters of affirmative action, even when it contrasted with interests of Jews. And yet blacks, 13% of the population, are considered a minority. Jews, less than 2% of the population, are not. That is partly by choice and partly by success. But Jews became leaders in the civil rights movement, both out of a sense of justice and self-interest. The more protections that were afforded in law to blacks, the more Jew hatred would recede as well, or so they thought. After Leo Frank was falsely accused of kidnapping and murder, this goes back to 1912, and his death sentence commuted, and he was lynched by an angry mob in Georgia, Jews created a host of self-defense organizations that still exist, even if they have strayed very far from their original purpose. Think about it. Just 2 weeks ago, the ADL offered guidelines for celebrating Halloween without cultural appropriation, meaning that they want to monitor people's costumes. How far removed from Judaism is that? But many Jews and Jewish organizations became pioneers in the struggle for equality of blacks. Jews contributed enormously in money and manpower to the NAACP after it was founded in 1909 and were among its leaders for 50 years. Take another case. The Scottsboro Boys, these are 1930s already, were nine black youth arrested and convicted in a sham trial of raping two white women in Alabama. Their appeal before the Supreme Court was handled by a Jewish lawyer, Walter Pollack. The case was reversed and retried. A lead attorney was Samuel Leibowitz. He objected to the exclusion of blacks from the jury. Decades later, that would become law through the Supreme Court. The trial went well, which doesn't mean the defendants were acquitted. This is Alabama, after all. And it was during the summation, the prosecution asked the jury, Is justice in the case going to be bought and sold in Alabama with Jew money from New York? Eventually, they were all convicted. 80 years later, they were all pardoned, which was small comfort. Most were executed or died within 2 years of their final conviction. Throughout the civil rights movement, Jews were in the forefront. Remember the Freedom Summer of 1964, two of the three Freedom Riders, Goodman and Schwerner, Jews, were killed. Black leaders reciprocated in the 1960s. Martin Luther King, for example, was very pro-Israel and offered pro-Israel statements after the Six-Day War. That ended already in the late 1960s with the struggles over affirmative action, which all Jews did not support, and eventually the war over Jewish teachers in New York being displaced by minority teachers, etc. And now it's safe to say, it's fair to say, that most of the black leadership is anti-Israel, if not anti-Jewish. Jews were instrumental in founding the ACLU, which at one time served a purpose to protect free speech, especially that of radicals. That too affected Jews, as one of the celebrated Supreme Court cases of the era, Abrams versus the United States, 1919, involved the conviction of a number of Jews, Abrams, Rosansky, and others, who had called for an end to American weapons manufacturing during World War I in violation of the Espionage Act of 1916, because they did not want U.S. troops or weapons to prop up the Russian government during the Russian Revolution. They wanted the communists to win. So Abrams and the rest of the Chevra had distributed leaflets in New York in English and Yiddish calling for resistance to the war effort and calling for a strike. First Amendment jurisprudence was completely different then, and needless to say, these cases eventually produced a Supreme Court reversal and a robust defense of First Amendment rights, and Jews were prominent in all of this because so many Jews were socialists and communists. Although not the Eugene V. Debs of WEVD fame, he himself was a Christian. It was almost inevitable, just fast forward, that ACLU Jews would be the ones to defend the rights of Nazis to march in a Jewish neighborhood in Skokie in the 1970s. And of course, the ACLU has compromised its ideological purity in recent years and no longer defends freedom of speech absolutely. Even stranger, the Nazi leader whose rights they were defending was a nut named Frank Collin, who was the son of Max Simon Cohn, a German Jew, survived Dachau, whose parents were murdered in the Holocaust, and who came to America and intermarried. Yes, the Nazi had a Jewish father who was a Holocaust survivor, only in America. Collin eventually denounced his father. Now, he's still alive, under a different name and occupation, having served a prison term for molesting a child, and he didn't mind at all that Jewish lawyers were defending him. Well, many Jews revoked their support of the ACLU after Skokie. They were proud to be doing what they were doing. Ultimately, the Nazis were allowed to march, but not in Skokie, in Chicago's Marquette Park. Nothing much came of it, but this case sharply divided the Jewish community. Famously, it was a case involving Jews that toppled the New Deal. One byproduct of the New Deal was massive government intrusion into private commerce with heavy control and regulation, something that Americans are again experiencing today. Schechter Poultry Corp. versus United States upset all of that. So the Schechters were kosher butchers who were convicted of violating the live poultry code by selling too many chickens at too low prices, and some of the chickens allegedly unfit. They vehemently denied that. So I knew one of the brothers. He lived in the building where my law office was, and I went to law school with his granddaughter. Interesting fellow. So they appealed. They were sentenced to jail terms, in fact. They appealed, and the Supreme Court reversed unanimously, saying that Congress can regulate interstate commerce, but not intrastate. And the Schechters only operated in New York. And this invalidated almost all the New Deal legislation, as it was unconstitutional for Congress to delegate its powers to unelected agencies. So we've traveled a long way from that decision. as it gave rise to FDR's suggestion that the Supreme Court be enlarged or packed to get more justices amenable to his viewpoint. That too sounds familiar. Eventually, one judge changed his mind, the composition of the court changed, and the regulatory state, that monster, was created. Another case that evokes strong feelings until today was the Rosenberg trial of 1951. Ethel and Julius Rosenberg were accused of passing atomic secrets to the Soviets. They were ratted out by her brother, David Greenglass, who had provided plans for the atomic bomb to Julius for delivery to the Soviets. He, Greenglass, worked on the Manhattan Project, was later sentenced to 15 years in prison, released in 1960, died in 2014. So it seems that despite all the protestations, Julius was guilty of sin, Ethel was guilty as well, but with some doubt as to the extent of her participation. That they were communists was beyond question. That Greenglass was a manipulative, lying communist sleaze also seems beyond doubt, although he did appeal to the judge not to execute the Rosenbergs. But he had never testified to the grand jury that his sister was involved, hence the continuing claims that she was innocent. It was an unusual trial in that the prosecution consisted of Jews, the defense attorneys were Jews, the defendants were Jews, and the judge was Jewish, Irving Kaufman, who after they were convicted by a jury, sentenced both to death by the electric chair in Sing Sing. And they were executed. June 19th, 1953, was a Friday night, right before sunset. A rabbi asked that they not be executed on Shabbat. And they were both buried in Wellwood Cemetery out in Pine Lawn. The fact that everyone involved in the trial was Jewish was purposeful and deflected potential claims of anti-Jewish bias. But the trial did catalyze the anti-communist fervor that was already extant, and Jews paid a price for that as well. Jews still argue the extent of the guilt of the two, but the establishment was immunized against charges of Jew hatred because they were all Jewish. Now, the Rosenbergs, unfortunately, were not the only Soviet spies who were Jews. One story that's come to light recently, my son gave me a book entitled Sleeper Agent, was the tale of George Koval. George Koval was born in Sioux City, Iowa, to Russian Jewish parents who returned to Russia during the Depression. They were communists, and they went to live in Birobidzhan, which is the Jewish autonomous province near Manchuria. So George Abramovich Koval, was educated in Soviet schools, but then he came back to America around 1940, went to Columbia University, and he joined the Manhattan Project and was working in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And he was recruited already by the GRU before he left the Soviet Union, and he spent years giving information to the Soviets on America's atomic project. And he was not the only one, unlike some of the others. He felt the noose tightening in 1947-48, and he was able to sneak back to the USSR in 1948, and he never returned. And he lived out the rest of his life basically in anonymity until he died in 2007. Vladimir Putin gave his family a posthumous award a year after he died. He died in 2006. The award was in 2007, but he was just another one. So you had a lot of Jews who were spies for the Soviets, not just the Rosenbergs and Kovals, but others. And typically, they don't know that each other exists. They're all operating independently. So the judicial system tried to immunize itself from charges of Jew hatred by having everybody there Jews. Were the defendants treated more harshly, the Rosenbergs, because they were Jews? Well, that's not unknown to us, and seems to have been the backdrop for the draconian treatment of Jonathan Pollard, who pleaded guilty to passing classified information to an ally. That was the crime, a crime for which the median sentence is 4 years, and yet he was sentenced to life. And this after the plea deal committed the government to not seeking a life sentence. His appeal was denied, with two Jewish justices, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Lawrence Silberman, affirming the conviction. And the sole non-Jew, Stephen Williams, termed Pollard's case a fundamental miscarriage of justice that required that Pollard be resentenced before a different judge. Quite a difference. And many Jews and Israelis wanted Pollard to just go away because he placed them in an uncomfortable position, oblivious to the profound assistance that he gave to Israeli security. Equal justice under the law remains the ideal, but is far from the reality. And of course, Jonathan Pollard is now an Olech Hadash almost 1 year. So finally, the last section of tonight's lecture, a few words about the Jewish justices to the Supreme Court, so based on a book by David Dallin, and what impact they've had on the court and jurisprudence. Has there been a particular Jewish interest or angle or jurisprudence? Certainly the Jewish justices of the last 30 years have taken a keen interest in abortion rights, none more so than Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And until Ginsburg died, the court, oddly enough, in a majority Protestant country, consisted of 6 Catholics and 3 Jews. When she died and was replaced by Amy Coney Barrett, now there's 7 Catholics and 2 Jews and no Protestants. Not much is made of that anomaly, more is made of the conservative-liberal divide. But in fact, you had for about a decade, 6 Catholics and 3 Jews, and now you have 7 Catholics and 2 Jews, and no Protestants at all. But we start at the beginning. There have been 8 Jewish Supreme Court justices of varying levels of Jewish commitment. Of the 8, 4 were raised in Orthodox families. Benjamin Cardozo, Felix Frankfurter, Arthur Goldberg, and Abe Fortas. None were more observant than Benjamin Cardozo, who at least kept a kosher home. Although he did stray from the piety of his parental home, he retained his family seat on the board of trustees of the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue in Manhattan, Cardozo being a quite well-known Jewish family. And in fact, he played an important role in that shul too, as we'll see. None were more viscerally uncomfortable with their Jewishness than was Felix Frankfurter, who openly stated that his Jewishness was, quote, an obstacle to be overcome rather than a heritage to be celebrated. Abe Fortas felt similarly, unsurprisingly, both intermarried. Let's start at the beginning. Louis Brandeis was the first Jew to serve on the Supreme Court. This almost 125 years since the court's beginning. He was a completely assimilated Jew, so assimilated that he celebrated a gift of a particular ham each year when he would receive it. He was born in Louisville. His grandfather had been a devotee of Jacob Frank, Yaakov Frank, the false messiah, who followed in Shabtai Tzvi's footsteps. His parents never celebrated anything Jewish, never belonged to any synagogue or temple, just like Lewis never did. His sole awareness of Judaism came from his uncle, Lewis Dembitz, who was religious, who was a prominent lawyer. In fact, he was a delegate for Abraham Lincoln at the 1860 Republican Convention. Brandeis did fondly recall spending a Shabbat with his uncle. And I quote, this is Brandeis, "The joy, the awe, the piety, the extra delicacies, the lighting of the candles, prayers over a cup of wine, quaint chants, Uncle Lewis poring over books most of the day, speaking of Shabbat peace." That sounds like Shabbat. All this had little impact on him. Brandeis married a second cousin and could easily have intermarried. The officiant was his brother-in-law Felix Adler, who had renounced Judaism to found the Ethical Culture Society. In any event, Brandeis left Kentucky, moved to New England, went to Harvard, became a famous and wealthy attorney with a passion for reform, labor laws, protection of the downtrodden, and especially antitrust legislation, for which he became a top advisor to Woodrow Wilson. When Wilson nominated him in 1916 for the Supreme Court, it wasn't uncontroversial. Some Jews opposed him, either because they did not want a Jew in a prominent position or they thought they should have been the Jew first nominated, Southerners vehemently opposed him just because he was Jewish. And Brandeis won confirmation only by a 47-22 vote, which was not common then to have such acrimony over Supreme Court justice. Brandeis has been back in the news because his theory of antitrust enforcement dominated jurisprudence for 70 years, summarized as big is bad. He was against monopolies, against any one company controlling an industry. In the 1980s, the court adopted a view associated with Justice Scalia, Italian Catholic, that the interests of the consumer should matter most, and not all monopolies are bad. Well, with the dominance of social media, the Brandeis view has regained some cogency that the concentration of power in any industry breeds income inequality and harms market competition. In fact, we've seen in America, it really harms the dissemination of news also. His influence will be felt in years to come, what's today termed in legal circles the new Brandeis school. He was also a stickler for protecting individuals from government intrusion, and later First Amendment jurisprudence was heavily affected by Brandeis's decisions. He was also the first justice, it's unbelievable if you think about it, the first justice to hire Jewish law clerks. No one had before. It's of course become quite common since. Brandeis was influential in another aspect as well. He became America's most famous Jewish Zionist, talked into it by meetings that he had in the early 1900s at a time when many prominent Jews feared to be associated with Zionism because of the dual loyalty charge. So he was part of the ZOA leadership, even played a small role in getting Wilson to acquiesce to the Balfour Declaration. And when he told the Jewish audience in 1914, I quote, "To be good Americans, we must be better Jews. And to be better Jews, we must become Zionists." He was instrumental in koshering Zionism to American Jews who were timid to assert themselves or be known as Jews. Brandeis was a political activist, even from the bench, helping to draft a statement of progressive political principles for the Democratic Party and secretly advising the FDR administration how to get around the Schechter decision. Some of his political work, which of course would be unheard of today, he did through a younger friend, Felix Frankfurter, who was literally on Brandeis's payroll. Brandeis never lived as a Jew. There was nothing Jewish at his funeral in 1941. He was even cremated. He's the most unlikely person to have a so-called Jewish university name for him. But he suffered as a Jew. One of his colleagues, Justice James McReynolds, took pride in never speaking a word to Brandeis, not ever saying a word to him, not even good morning, in the roughly 20 years they served together on the bench. In 1932, when a vacancy opened on the court, he, McReynolds, and two other justices, when they heard who Hoover was considering, implored Herbert Hoover not to afflict us with another Jew, which Hoover did anyway, a Jew named Benjamin Cardozo. So Cardozo came from a good Sephardi family, all observant Jews active in the Orthodox community, great nephew of Gershon Mendez Sejas, who was the Chazan of Sher Yisrael in the late 18th century. Cardozo had his bar mitzvah there, read Parshat Bamidbar, always maintained a seat there, even if he stopped attending, certainly when he lived in Washington. And yet, I think it was the late 1890s, early 1900s, at a very contentious shul meeting, Cardozo argued that introducing mixed seating in the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue would violate the shul's constitution. And in so doing, he preserved Sher Yisrael's Orthodox status until today. Cardozo graduated Columbia, passed the bar at 21, joined a law firm. He was considered a legal genius, eventually elevated to the U.S. Supreme Court from the New York State Court of Appeals, which is quite uncommon, and where he'd also been the first Jew to sit. And Hoover nominated him, even though he'd be the second Jew and the third New Yorker on the bench, and a Democrat to boot. Hoover was Republican, which is a testament to Cardozo's reputation as a jurist. And he was approved by the Senate by acclamation, unlike Brandeis. Cardozo was strict. In 1935, for example, Jewish protesters illegally boarded a German ship docked in New York, tore down the Nazi flag, and provoked a riot. A New York judge, Jewish judge, Louis Bronski, dismissed the charges against them. Cardozo was horrified, embarrassed that Jews would take the law into their own hands and that a judge would almost endorse it. And he wouldn't be the last Jewish judge to look at Jews with a more critical eye. Just think of Ginsburg and Silberman in the Pollard case. Cardozo did not enjoy the Supreme Court or Washington, was not close to Brandeis, never married or had children, and found the whole experience lonely, and he died in 1938, having served only 6 years on the bench. He, like Brandeis, made his mark in the protection of individual rights. Cardozo was succeeded by Felix Frankfurter, who was a Harvard professor, very close to FDR since the two attended Harvard Law School together. Frankfurter was born in Vienna, was raised in a religious home, and he drifted, literally drifted. As a City College sophomore, he walked out of the davening on Yom Kippur and never came back. I've seen people leave, but they come back. He never came back to shul the rest of his life, and he became antagonistic, seeing his Judaism as a barrier he had to overcome. He intermarried. It was a civil wedding performed by Cardozo, but boycotted by Frankfurter's own mother. His wife had mental issues, and Frankfurter, like Cardozo, also had no children. And yet, when he was appointed to the court, Frankfurter ruminated, "If only my mother were alive to see this." It was Brandeis, with whom he was very close, who made Felix into a Zionist. And Felix Frankfurter even attended the Paris Peace Conference in 1919 and was the recipient of the famous letter from the Emir Faisal, who is the son of Hussein, the Sharif of Mecca, who wrote these words, 1919, right after the Balfour Declaration. "The Arabs," I quote, "the Arabs, especially the educated among us, look with the deepest sympathy on the Zionist movement. Our deputation here in Paris is fully acquainted with the proposals submitted yesterday by the Zionist organization to the peace conference, and we regard them as moderate and proper. We will do our best, insofar as we are concerned, to help them through. We will wish the Jews a most hearty welcome home." And the Emir Faisal endorsed the Balfour Declaration. And Frankfurter responded, "Royal Highness, allow me on behalf of the Zionist organization to acknowledge your recent letter with deep appreciation. Those of us who come from the United States have already been gratified by the friendly relations and the active cooperation maintained between you and the Zionist leaders, particularly Dr. Weizmann. We knew it could not be otherwise. We knew that the aspirations of the Arab and the Jewish peoples were parallel, that each aspired to reestablish its nationality in its homeland, each making its own distinctive contribution to civilization, each seeking its own peaceful mode of life. The Zionist leaders and the Jewish people for whom they speak have watched with satisfaction the spiritual vigor of the Arab movement, themselves seeking justice. They're anxious that the just national aims of the Arab people be confirmed and safeguarded by the peace conference." Sounds great. Well, it didn't quite work, but nevertheless. In the 1920s, Frankfurter taught at Harvard. He became embroiled in controversy, opposing Harvard's Jew-hating President Lawrence Lowell in his imposition of quotas limiting Jewish enrollment. He drew close again to FDR, who offered him the position of Solicitor General, but Frankfurter turned it down, annoying FDR, but allowing him to appoint Frankfurter to succeed Cardozo just a few years later. The New York Times opposed Frankfurter just as it had opposed Brandeis. Even as a justice, Frankfurter remained an advisor to FDR, and he tried to pressure FDR to facilitate Jewish immigration and oppose the Nazis, but he refused to intervene personally, considered it an abuse of friendship when his own uncle, Solomon Frankfurter, who was the leader of the Viennese Jews, was arrested. Worse, in 1943, when Jan Karski, the Polish diplomat, briefed Frankfurter on Nazi atrocities, Frankfurter told him, I quote, "I'm unable to believe you," end quote. Challenged, he clarified, "I did not say you are lying. I said, I'm unable to believe you. There's a difference. And Frankfurter did not bring this news to Roosevelt. Not that it would have mattered, because Roosevelt knew anyway. Even worse, one of Frankfurter's close friends was John McCloy, who's the Assistant Secretary of War during World War II, who infamously said that the U.S. would not bomb Auschwitz lest, I quote, it provoke more vindictive action by the Germans, end quote. What they could do more vindictive than Auschwitz is hard to imagine, and McCloy never clarified. But Frankfurter was close to McCloy and to Henry Stimson, and there's no evidence that he ever made any request on behalf of the beleaguered Jews of Europe. If you think about it, the gangsters did more to save European Jewry than did the justices. On the bench, Frankfurter became a judicial conservative. His troubled attitude towards religion, marked by a number of cases, including his decision upholding the blue laws that closed stores on Sunday and harmed Shomrei Shabbat. But Frankfurter felt, even wrote, minorities must accommodate their new country, not the opposite. But he was instrumental in the Brown versus Topeka Board of Education that desegregated the public school system. When the case was first heard, Brown would have lost. It was Frankfurter who urged the delay in the decision when he realized the court would not rule in favor of Brown, and in the interim, a new Chief Justice was appointed, Earl Warren. The case was reheard, and the decision unanimous. Thurgood Marshall, later to be a justice, received the most acclaim for arguing this case, Brown versus Topeka Board of Education, but there were consolidated cases from other jurisdictions, and here, Jews were involved. Milton Corman argued one case, and the legendary Jack Greenberg another. Greenberg succeeded Marshall as the chair of the NAACP legal defense team, and he argued scores of civil rights cases before the Supreme Court, also taught at Columbia for many decades. So this is the affinity that Jews have for law. Greenberg said once in an interview about practicing before the Supreme Court, he said, I quote, "It was like a religious experience. The first few times I was there, I was full of awe. I had an almost tactile feeling. The first time I was in court, I wasn't arguing. I felt as if I were in a synagogue and reached to see whether or not I had a yarmulke on. I thought I ought to have one on." Frankfurter also broke the color barrier by hiring the first black law clerk, but he refused to hire a female clerk, saying the court is not ready for that. Ironically, the rejected female was a young Ruth Bader Ginsburg. It was FDR, through Felix Frankfurter, who created the tradition of a Jewish seat on the Supreme Court. So when Frankfurter retired in 1962, Kennedy appointed his own friend, well-known labor lawyer and then Secretary of Labor, Arthur Goldberg, as his successor. So Goldberg was raised in a religious home, always remained active in the Jewish community, had positive feelings towards Judaism. He saw himself as an activist liberal judge, writing the Escobedo decision, which acknowledged 5-4 constitutional right to counsel, even during interrogations, and he began the crusade to end the death penalty. He was always a proud Jew. It was Goldberg who convinced his colleagues to let an Orthodox Jewish female attorney cover her hair in the Supreme Court, even though court rules barred any head coverings. So when I was sworn in to practice before the Supreme Court, I wore my yarmulke. No one said a word. He didn't serve long. In one of the dumbest moves ever made, that's his own words, after 3 years on the court, he resigned his seat under pressure from Lyndon Johnson to become the UN ambassador. Rumor has it that LBJ dangled in front of Goldberg a potential nomination as his vice president in 1968 or a return to the court, but as Supreme Court Chief Justice. Of course, Johnson didn't run for re-election. At the UN, Goldberg made a famous speech after the Six-Day War, and he worked on UN Resolution 242, but he didn't accomplish much more than that. He was then hired by the law firm Paul Weiss and Rifkin and others, but only after the firm revoked its policy against hiring Shomrei Shabbat attorneys. He has that credit on his ledger as well. Goldberg was succeeded by LBJ's personal friend, Abe Fortas, who also had an unremarkable tenure and then had to resign because of scandal. So Fortas also came from a religious home, but he abandoned it all in college and later intermarried. He actually represented and argued before the court the case of Gideon versus Wainwright that guaranteed counsel to all poor people, one of the clauses of the Miranda warnings that criminal defendants are always received when they're arrested, that they have the right to counsel. That was Fortas' case. It was odd that LBJ forced out Goldberg to appoint Fortas to the court. Fortas didn't want the position, mainly because he and his wife did not want to accept the pay cut that would encroach on their lavish lifestyle. His wife, who was also a lawyer, turned down an appointment to the D.C. Court of Appeals. LBJ cajoled him. Typical Johnson, he announced the appointment before Fortas agreed. And the announcement outraged Fortas' wife, who didn't talk to Johnson for 3 months. And he probably regretted it as well, because he antagonized everybody, did Fortas. He continued to advise LBJ on policy issues, advised him to escalate the bombing in Vietnam, and he was a strong and positive influence on LBJ during the Six-Day War. He was very controversial. LBJ even nominated him to replace Warren as Chief Justice, but Fortas had so angered senators that his nomination was filibustered, and he then accused the senators of being, among other things, anti-Semitic. Not long thereafter, he was forced to resign from the court when accused of financial improprieties. Nixon ended the tradition of a Jewish seat. In his defense, by then, it was probably hard to find a Jew who was a judicial conservative and a Republican, but that returned with a vengeance in the 1990s. All right, in the 80s, Ronald Reagan nominated Douglas Ginsburg to the court, but Ginsburg had to withdraw when he admitted to smoking marijuana. Now, I think it's a prerequisite for service in public life. And this after the failed nomination of Robert Bork. So Bill Clinton nominated Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer, who's raised reform, now intermarried. And apparently he had other Jews on his shortlist. When Barack Obama appointed Elena Kagan, it marked the first time that three Jews served on the court together. Kagan was famous for being the first girl to have a bat mitzvah at Lincoln Square Synagogue, where her parents were members, but they were not necessarily Orthodox. As Rabbi Riskin recalled, he refused to let her read from the Torah in the morning. They had a Friday night private affair at which she read Megillat Rut, but Kagan was not satisfied with that. When she joined the court, she had never before served as a judge, although she had been Solicitor General, and she, like Cardozo, was also unmarried. All three, Ginsburg, Breyer, and Kagan, were ideological soulmates, activist judges who saw the Constitution as a document that evolved, strangely enough, evolved perfectly aligned with their political and social preferences. Maybe not by coincidence, they perceive the Torah the same way. They're very weak on the protection of religious liberties, but they all became the most outspoken proponents of abortion rights. Indeed, as a recent JTA report last month on the Jewish interest in the current Supreme Court term that led with the most important Jewish interest, which is abortion. It's apparently now a Jewish interest that touches on freedom of worship, a bit surprising as the Rambam did not include abortion in Sefer Avodah. So for sure, three Jews on the court, now it's back to two, and Breyer's being pressured to resign so another ethnic identity box can be checked off, was a notable achievement. Jews had made it. From the reluctance to appoint the first Jew, Brandeis, to the current circumstance where Jews were desired, that is a sea change in American Jewish life. It's not too much to assert that it seems those days are behind us, and Democrat presidents will be obligated to appoint anyone but white Jews as justices, because Jews are now the establishment, and Republican presidents will labor to find conservative justices who are Jews. There's a small handful, but not many. It's undeniable, though, that the trajectory marked tremendous progress for Jews, and the influence Jews have had on the law has been profound. Fortunately, our organized criminal behavior has mostly receded, but the Jewish commitment to human and civil rights, individual freedoms, and protection of the downtrodden are all reflected in the laws passed and the cases that have been adjudicated by the Jewish judges. I thank you all for participating. Next time we're going to discuss American Jews, American Jewish Experience Part 3, American Jews and Science. I thank you all very much.